Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. For this podcast, we are having another EBM special. That's right, evidence-based medicine. That group has partnered up with us, and we are so thankful for the support because we are talking more about some of the great recent stuff they have been publishing, and that includes their pediatric side. So if you did not know, they have pediatric and adult medicine topics, and this time around, we're going to talk about pediatric appendicitis. As with last time, if you are wanting to learn more about this, feel free to go to our website, totalem.org, click on the links that we have there because you will be able to review the article for free and it's included in the show notes. So please check that out. But we'll talk more at the end about options about how you can go and learn some more about EBM medicine. We see abdominal pain all the time. Now, sometimes it comes as abdominal pain with that nice clean label. Other times it is the little kid that comes in with a sore throat, a fever, and their belly hurts. Okay. Is the sore throat really something? Is it more about the abdominal pain? Is it more about the fever? What is it that we need to be concerned about? And the reason why I bring this up is because we, especially as PAs and NPs, but anyone across the spectrum, we see a variety of complaints. We see a variety of patients who come in, and a lot of times, you know, especially if they start saying that they have a sore throat or some upper respiratory symptoms with it, okay, well, it's probably nothing, and let's go ahead and make that, you know, an ESI level 4 or 5. Next thing you know, we have these patients sitting in a room where it's supposed to be fast track or something's supposed to quickly be seen, and we get this anchor bias that occurs, and we look at them, we say, probably looks like a sore throat, but it sounds viral. Let's go ahead and send you home. So maybe you don't even do any testing with it, which we've talked about in other podcasts about why you should probably go ahead and do the testing. But let's say you have a kid where it sounds like that abdominal pain may be more of a secondary symptom. You may be right, but it is worth investigating a little bit more that abdominal pain and double checking. So let's say you talk a little bit more and it starts sounding like that pain is maybe a little more right lower quadrant and it's been going on for a little bit. Now it starts getting a little more challenging. We have to think a little bit more. Is this actually something we need to consider versus something that it's probably a secondary symptom? And this is where we as clinicians have to take it to the next level because we cannot ignore this. At least we shouldn't, because otherwise we can miss an important diagnosis. And one of these important diagnoses is appendicitis, because appendicitis can become a surgical emergency very quickly. And so what we're going to talk about here is how to go through that process, because there's lots of different ways and there's a little bit of mix with evidence and stuff like that. And I feel like EB Medicine did a very good job with this publication about how to do this in a safe and efficient manner. And like I said, we're going to take this a little bit more from the PA angle, but this is open to the same for those who are working in rural or remote settings or NPs or physicians. It doesn't matter. What I want you guys to think about is how that mindset is so important to consider as we're looking through this. So let's talk about that a little bit more. Like I said, maybe it's a shift where I'm working primarily on the fast track side. So this kid comes in with their parents and he's had an upper respiratory type infection for the last couple of days. At least that's what it seems to them. They said he's had a little bit of a cold, but they're worried because now he's throwing up. And then you talk a little bit more and, well, what kind of upper respiratory symptoms? Oh, some runny nose and some congestion. You know, the usual stuff allergy-wise. We didn't think much of it because he's been having it for about a week. But now for the last couple of days, he's been throwing up and he has a fever. And so, you know, he's 3 or 4 years old, so he can't give you a ton of information, but he really just doesn't look that great. You push around and he acts like he's sore and you try and have him point to where it hurts the most. And now he's pointing to the right lower quadrant. This is where you can have gone one of two directions. You could have just gone with, okay, fever, belly pain, probably because of the fever, probably the vomiting because of that. And you could have moved on. But instead, you did the right thing here. You went and investigated a little bit more. So now the question becomes, do you have to do any sort of testing? Okay, so what kind of exams do you do? We're going to talk about that a little bit more in a second. But let's talk about some of the false positives first, some of the things that can make you start thinking this abdominal pain, because like I said, I've talked about it enough and we've beaten around it a little bit, but let's talk about some of the things you need to keep in your differential. Now, there's a great graph from the website, and I'm not going to go through all of it because I do have it in the show notes, but let's talk about some of the classic ones for kids this age. So we could have some more significant issues. We could have intussusception. We could have Meckel diverticulitis. We could have an ovarian or testicular torsion. You know, those are types of things that we have to keep in mind. We could have a ruptured ovarian cyst. If they're old enough and they're still a pediatric patient, you know, there's always the possibility of pregnancy-related complications, including an ectopic pregnancy that had not yet been diagnosed, as well as complications like preeclampsia or HELLP syndrome. And then we also have to think about the things of kidney stones are always a possibility, or UTIs. And then finally, there's other things too, you know, these extra abdominal causes. We talked a little bit about the sore throat, so strep pharyngitis or other URI type symptoms where we have some sinus drainage with it that could be upsetting the stomach. That's a possibility. But then we have to keep in mind things like DKA, hemolytic uremic syndrome, Hennig-Schlotman purpura, or osteomyelitis of the hip. You know, these types of things are very real possibilities. It's just why it's so important to do a good general exam. That's why really anytime we have a patient who comes in with complaints, it's a good idea to listen to them, you know, auscultation, lungs, heart, checking the abdomen, checking for tenderness, because sometimes as you're talking to that patient who's been complaining of a little bit of congestion and that fever, next thing you know, you push around their stomach and they're very tender. Well, now you know to change your exam around a little bit, just like we're talking about with this 3 or 4 year old that comes in with their parents. So now you ask yourself, okay, we have a differential, we have a little bit of history. What physical exam findings should I pay attention to? There's all sorts of signs that we look for. McBurney's point tenderness, psoas sign, obturator sign, Ravsing sign, checking for pain with heel strikes or having them jump or cough or stuff like that. Some of those are a little more effective than others, and that's why we look at certain tools to help us out. Because with those tools, we find that there are some common themes. Ravsing's, obturators, maybe not as helpful. McBurney's point tenderness sometimes come up, but it's really just general right lower quadrant pain that we're looking for, especially if that pain has migrated over time. The most common is that periumbilical pain that migrates over a couple of days into the right lower quadrant and now sits there. That would be the more typical presentation. A lot of times, too, is that they may have some rebound or guarding of their abdomen that can be hard to pick up sometimes, but that's what we're looking for, as well as clinically, are they nauseated or having active vomiting? Do they have a decreased appetite? One thing I usually ask younger children is I ask them if they're hungry at all, because their parents may say, well, they haven't been eating that great, but I'll ask them like, hey, do you want anything to eat right now? Especially if this is a low risk scenario where I might actually try a PO challenge, maybe after some oral Zofran, for example. I would say ondansetron, but I sometimes have a hard time nailing it. So if you hear me say Zofran, I'm trying to get around that pronunciation. So you give them the Zofran and you give them a little bit of fluids and maybe even some crackers. You see how they hold up and then you discharge them home. But in general, some of the key things, some of the classic types of things that come into different scoring systems or algorithms are the anorexia, nausea, vomiting, migrating pain or pain to the right lower quadrant, pain usually with like percussion, coughing, hopping, walking, those types of things. And then we start getting into lab work. So unfortunately, if you're going to use a lot of these scoring systems, especially the ones that have been a little more validated, you're going to need to get a CBC because we want to look at the white blood cells and the neutrophils. Almost always, that's what they're wanting to see, as well as the potential for bands. The three big ones that we're talking about are the pediatric appendicitis score, which is PAS, the Alvarado scoring system, and then most recently, the pediatric appendicitis risk calculator. I like this one. This is very new. This has only been around for the last couple of years. But the pediatric appendicitis risk calculator, or PARC, does have some added benefits. It looks more at certain factors and gives a realistic percentage based on age and presentation versus just a point system. and does have very high sensitivities and specificities based on the current data. Now, given there's not a lot of validating studies, there's only really two studies right now that have talked about this, the original study and the validation study, but it's something to at least start looking into more, and I think maybe something to consider more in the future, especially because it can help us with the whole algorithm approach, as was brought up in the EB Medicine paper and how they talk about how to go through the steps. So like I said, now we're taking a patient who may have been a little less impressive on the presentation, or maybe could have been one that was initially missed by triage and now they're on that fast track side. So let's not miss that patient. Let's start doing some more testing. So you decide that based on your initial assessment, let's go ahead and let's do some blood work, because a lot of times the way I'm using this is, if this is such a low risk scenario, like for example, I sometimes get kids who come in with the classic nausea, vomiting, diarrhea that's been going on for, you know, just a few hours, but parents got concerned because of the onset of symptoms and because the patient's complaining of abdominal pain. So they get a higher triage level and they're in the main ED. But I look at them, you know, they're great, they're playful, they're active, they're running around the room, they're bouncing up and down, and they're eating a popsicle. Do I still need to do the workup for that patient because the parents have concern for appendicitis? Do I still need to get blood work? Well, potentially in this case, I could say they're so well appearing that maybe they can just go home. But what I like to do is, maybe this is the time I'm going to use the pediatric appendicitis score or the Alvarado score. And what I do is I throw in all the points and I assume that they have an elevated white count and that they have an elevated neutrophil count as well. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I'm assuming worst case scenario. And if I still have them at a low risk, then I explain to parents how, hey, even if we did the blood work, it really wouldn't help us in this case because he's so low risk. Maybe instead we opt for you guys to keep monitoring this at home. We'll give you some medicine. And if things worsen in some way or the symptoms persist, then here's what I want you to do next, which is usually for them to come back to us. And that is another approach that you can use. I think it's something that's very viable. It's not something that was really as discussed in this article, but I think for us as clinicians, when we're working in settings where we have to decide when we quickly see these patients sick or not sick, and then what level of workup do we need for the appropriate disposition, this is that other route we can go. We can use these scores to help back up our clinical decision making. I think this is really important for us as PAs, NPs, those working in rural settings, because we usually don't have the same backup. And sometimes we don't have the same level of experience as those who are working in tertiary care specialty centers, you know, the pediatric hospitals where they have attending physicians that are seeing patients all the time who have 10, 20 or more years of experience. These are probably the same people who are not listening to this podcast anyway. If they are, I would love to have them on as guests because I think I can get so much information from them anyway. But for us who don't see this day in, day out, or maybe are not as always comfortable with the presentation, or maybe just want something to help the parents be reassured that it's not just us and just our opinion alone, these scores can help us guide and help with making the decisions to really have better understanding of EBM and shared decision making, which I feel like goes really well hand in hand. Okay, so we have a patient where we decided that we need to do the lab work. Now, usually what I'm going to try and do at the same time is, while labs are pending and while we're debating if we want to go ahead and get imaging or not based on the current score without the blood work, then I'm going to start giving this patient IV access. Remember that they need to be NPO, so nothing by mouth. We're going to give them IV fluids if needed for hydration, especially if they appear dehydrated. Children can be very tricky, so if they start appearing at all dehydrated, I'm going to go ahead and push the IV fluids, especially since I don't want them to have anything by mouth if I have any real concern. And then, you know, treating the pain. This is a big one. I feel like a lot of times we forget about the importance of giving pain medications. And it's not really going to mask our exam. There's some evidence out there, given not a ton, but there's some evidence to kill this dogma that we can't treat pain because it will obscure the exam. This is total crap, and we need to move past this point because all we're doing is leaving them in pain, and it makes it harder to do a proper evaluation to see if symptoms improve. Now, maybe the child looks really well, and when you're pushing on their stomach, they're only a little bit tender. I'll ask family, like, what do they want to do about pain medicine? And sometimes they may elect to hold off, and we may just try the IV Zofran first and see how they hold up with that. If they have significant improvement of their symptoms and their pain's resolved, then okay, that makes me feel better too. But if we're going to give pain medicine, keep in mind that you can give morphine, fentanyl, or other opioid derivatives as you choose. Keep in mind we want to avoid ones like tramadol or codeine, given the complications in pediatric patients and in the general population, but most importantly in the pediatric patients. So I tend to lean maybe a little bit more towards fentanyl just because it's a little bit of a cleaner drug. It's a little bit easier to use. But whatever your drug of choice is, make sure that you're giving it early and to help control the pain. A lot of times what I'm doing when I'm seeing these patients, I have the initial visit where I'm checking, I see the abdominal pain, it's periumbilical, maybe a little bit favoring the right lower quadrant. I get the labs, we get the medications. I go back in to update them as to what those show, and I do a repeat examination at that time. Most of the time with these patients, if I'm getting as far as blood work, there's a really good chance that we're going to get imaging. Maybe not always, especially if there's a huge turnaround and parents feel much better and they just want their kid to go home. We'll have that discussion at that of risks versus benefits of this decision, including worsening and potential worsening of appendicitis. So that's something that may come up there, but I'm at least going to re-examine the patient before they go. Now, let's go back to that scenario. So we examine them the first time on the initial visit. We come back and we update, we re-examine again. So let's say the pain really hasn't changed, some improvement of their reported pain, but still quite a bit of tenderness on exam. Well, then we were going to go and get the imaging. And no matter what, after the imaging, we're going to go back and reassess them again. I like to have 3 abdominal exams in most cases, especially for patients that are going home that are kind of that more moderate risk group. Low risk, maybe not such a big deal. Moderate or higher risk patients, the more serial exams you can do and demonstrate your efforts of what you're trying to do, the better that it will look and the better that you will be able to gauge what's going on. So I am usually doing a few exams on these patients. So third exam rolls around after we get the imaging. And let's say on the imaging, I don't see the appendix and we can't get a clear picture. So now I'm coming back in and talking about the possibility of CT versus admission observation. Well, now if their pain's getting a whole lot worse and maybe they're febrile now, this could be the time when I talk to the surgeon and see if we want to go ahead and proceed to prolonged observation versus CT versus sometimes maybe based on their score and current findings to go ahead and take them for exploratory surgery. Again, this is going to very much be a patient-dependent basis, which is why it's so important for us to be able to talk to someone, whether that's the pediatrician on call, for the lower risk patients who we still feel more comfortable about staying in the hospital for maybe a longer observation period, or the surgeon, because maybe we really do think that this is a potential early appendicitis, or if we do have a confirmed case of appendicitis, to get the appropriate management, including surgery and antibiotics, or to an attending physician in the emergency department or whoever's on call, because understanding that we don't always have someone who's in the department. Many of us who are listening to this podcast are working in such remote settings that we may be only talking to someone by a phone call, but having someone to consult and just getting a little more information can be beneficial, especially when it's late in our shift and everyone's tired and we're not thinking at the best that we normally would if we had just woken up and just started our shift. So with all that said, the biggest thing is we should probably talk to someone when we have a concern in the scenario that this could be appendicitis. Once we do, we want to move on to our next stage, and that is getting that appropriate disposition. Let's move to the case where we have positive findings on the ultrasound. Now, to back up for one quick second, you could use point-of-care ultrasound if you are savvy in this. If you're not savvy, take a course. There's ones out there like Practical Pocus, which provides point-of-care ultrasound training. And this is something you can easily do and easily practice. But if you haven't done this yet and you're not comfortable with it yet, get the confirmatory study. And especially if you're in the learning phase with trying to incorporate ultrasound for the role of appendicitis, get a practice exam in, especially if the patient does have positive findings, whether it's done by the radiology ultrasound or by CT, to see if you can find it yourself. The more you can practice this and get better at it, the better you can be over time and the quicker you can improve the disposition. So if I had, say, seen that patient initially and their symptoms are a little concerning, I go ahead and I grab the ultrasound, I find the appendix, it is enlarged, it is non-compressible, it has the ring of fire appearance, as we've talked about in a previous podcast. All those types of things, if I'm seeing that, we're done. You know, I can talk to the surgeon and we can get appropriate management. Now, if they want further testing or confirmatory studies, that is a different conversation to have. But at least we can know, you know, in an hour or less versus several hours later after we've had to do the ultrasound, which couldn't identify anything, and then the CT, which now exposed the patient to radiation, which increases their lifetime risk of cancer. But whatever your decision point is, when you finally get to the point that you had the diagnosis of appendicitis, you want to get the surgeon on the phone. Sometimes they may wait until the morning, especially in the middle of the night shift. But if it's earlier in the day, they'll try and get them in the surgery schedule. The antibiotics that you can give in the meantime will depend a little bit based on their allergies. But in general, we're going to do ceftriaxone and we're going to do metronidazole. Keep in mind, there are alternative antibiotics that you can use, such as if there's an allergy to penicillin-based medications or beta-lactams in general, which there is some good information that probably in most of these cases, it's very antibiotic-specific and there are exceptions to it. That would be, again, a different podcast that I hope to have soon. We can decide what we need to do, but let's say we can't use beta-lactams for some reason. So we can't do ceftriaxone, we can't do piperacillin, tazobactam for some reason. Well, instead, we can go with a different option, such as ciprofloxacin, which was also mentioned in the paper. But in general, we're doing ceftriaxone, 50 to 75 milligrams per kilogram per day, usually given as a single dose, up to 2,000 milligrams, and then metronidazole, 10 milligrams per kilogram as a dose, up to 500 milligrams for a dose every 8 hours. And we're going to continue with the pain medicine and get them to surgery. Again, if this was a really low-risk patient, that patient's going to go home with good return precautions and, as hopefully can be arranged, outpatient follow-up or coming back to the emergency department, depending on the severity of symptoms. Then we have the kind of more moderate risk, but we don't have a definite cause, but maybe they have some clinical improvement, or maybe it's one that's a little bit of a wishy-washy case, either talking to the pediatrician or the surgeon, whatever is appropriate for your facility, for observation versus going ahead and doing more advanced imaging. And then finally, for your high-risk patients, if you clinically suspect it, they meet all the classic findings, they're high risk for appendicitis, you can go ahead and just talk to your surgeon and see if you want to do any other testing. If they decide not to, then they can go ahead and take them to the OR just that much more quickly. Those are the key highlights. And like I said, there's a ton of information and we are only hitting some of the main points that I take away from this, especially as a PA practicing in the ED. You may find that your situations are going to be different, but I would highly encourage to review this paper. And don't forget, if you want to learn more about EB medicine and learn more about great topics like this, go to ebmedicine.com. If you click on our link for the show notes, you can get $50 or more off of your subscription with EB medicine. All you have to do is go to totalem.org, go to podcast 165, find our podcast on this, the EB medicine podcast, and towards the bottom of the page, you'll be able to click on a link to get the discount. And then if you're listening to this because you already have EB medicine, you can go ahead and get the CME as well. Otherwise, I look forward to talking to you more in the future. We're going to have more topics coming up as we are hoping to do this as a monthly routine. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.